Okay, our second speaker this afternoon is Lars Hansen from the Technical University of Denmark.
Thank you.
Yeah,
so I'm going to speak to you this afternoon about the knowledge discovery in neuroimaging databases. And the database that I'm going to do knowledge discovery in, a database similar to what we just heard, namely a database that consists of coordinates and metadata. So this is my outline, and part of the thrill here is that I'm going to do a live demo of a search engine that we have running at the Technical University of Denmark, the so-called Brede search engine and database. And this tool is something that is developed by my postdoc, Finn Wolf Nielsen, in particular, and now he's assisted by two programmers that are developing a new interface that I'm going to speak about in towards the end. So what do I mean when I say knowledge discovery? So there are some definitions. There are books about knowledge discovery, also how it relates to data mining. It's very closely related to data mining, but it's sort of brings data mining to a level also where it tries to convert the patterns that we find in data mining into knowledge. And that knowledge is very often taking sort of the form of visualizations. And this is something that, of course, rings very well with this field that we do, neuroimages. We have very complicated data sets and we summarize them as an image. And this is the way we conventionally extract knowledge from neuroimaging experiments. So what we're talking about here is to take a look at many such images and try to see if we can come up with visualizations of what is in common and maybe also sometimes what is differences between these various result images that we get from individual studies. Little logo here that I'm using is one of the very early ways that we displayed our results, namely as these kind of virtual reality environments that are interactive, so you can move around in them and you can put these different, say, like for example the atlas here, you can put specific pages from the atlas in and some, say, these different visualizations of function and so on to navigate the virtual environments. And part of what we do in the visualization is to produce such virtual reality displays, but often it's also just images that we produce. So when we narrow in on knowledge discovery in biomedicine, there are some specific challenges, and they are certainly very visible in the field of neuroimaging. So one thing that we that sort of making this less easy than, for example, data mining in what we call market basket analysis. So this is like patterns of how consumer behaves in shops and so on, is the biological viability. So we have this situation where people are collecting data, and the way data is collected, we've heard about this several times during the workshop, is of course very heterogeneous. It's very chaotic also. There's no plan. I mean, we just randomly collect data and hope that it will make sense as a whole. There's a lot of noise in the sense that that there are parameters that are not defined, as we heard before, that people do not always describe exactly what they do. So we operate certainly under uncertainty in this business. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't do this kind of integrative activities. And one reason that was emphasized paper actually last week in Science by Evans is the increasing specialization that takes place in the sciences and the biosciences in particular. Namely that we specialize in smaller and smaller areas, and therefore it gets less and less likely that we'll use discoveries that are made that are maybe even really relevant for what we do in other areas. And this is why we need search engines that can search for information that are vaguely defined and maybe search engines that work in the sense that we are searching for something we don't know is there. It's not like retrieving something from memory. It's really looking for something that we can hope that is there. Sometimes we may not even be able to state precisely what it is that we're looking for. So these search engines should be increasingly proactive in the sense that they should guess what would be of interest for us. I'll speak about an interface for search search later on. The traditional review meta-analysis mechanisms are of course hampered by the sheer amount of neuroimaging that is produced. We saw a plot in the previous talk how this exponential increase in publications makes it virtually impossible to follow the by the usual manual mechanisms for creating reviews. When we say that, we should also say that there's another problem with neuroimaging, that is that the databasing progress has been really slow, especially if we compare with some of the other, say, bioinformatics, for example. And I'm not sure that the three reasons that I'm sort of hinting at here are the main reasons. I heard last night that there may also be some much more concrete business market-like mechanisms that have made it so popular, active in bioinformatics, but certainly we have this problem that the neuroimaging findings are probably more ill-defined than sequence information in bioinformatics, so it's simply harder to make good databases. It may also be less obvious at present what the rewards are from sharing neuroimaging data. In bioinformatics, it's quite clear. I mean, they've been aware of for many years that you need a large amount of data to get results. And we sort of have this illusion we can get results just from a few subjects. And this has been challenged, of course, also during this workshop. So this may be more clear in the future also, that we really need to do sharing. So we have our own data, and we need to see it in the context of what is there already when we want to make stable inference. And then, of course, there's the angst also that imaging is so hard that maybe I'm not using my data optimally. So it may be that somebody will find errors when I release my data, or even worse, that they find a Nobel Prize in my data and run away with it. That would be unpleasant, of course. So just a few words about the nature. We have already heard about what's sort of the structure of the databases. So we have data sets, of course, and they are most often in the form of activation foci. There are a couple of databases that have tried to store complete data sets, like MRI-PC and Neurogenerator in Stockholm, and it's been very hard for them to get serious amounts of data in their databases. There are many reasons for that, I'm sure, but that would be the optimal thing to have the raw data, of course. Along with the neuroimaging result images or raw data, we have the metadata that describes what happened during the study, interpretations of the maps and so on. All that is stored in our databases. And often these databases, they have models that describe the structure. I'm going to speak about this in a moment for our little database. And they have links to other databases. I'm going to describe that also, how we link to and make the databases interoperable. There's this issue of inclusion criteria that is really an issue. And it's certainly not one that we have solved. The data that we have in our database are completely random. There's even a bias towards Danish studies and so on. It's really bad. So we are very cautious when we do analysis in our database and try to make some general inferences about, you know, what is more likely to be found in a specific place. Then we have to do something that go beyond the actual sample we have. I'll show an example. And then the databases, they have search functionality, and that's what I'm going to demo in a moment. Part of the hope that that we can do something sensible, of course, is that we hope that we have really robust and efficient machine learning tools, and I'll show some examples of what we have done. So just to, I'm sure we're going to hear more about this in a moment, about the brain map database. This is our role model. The numbers, to give a sort of impression of the size, I copied those numbers today. They increase every day because you have an active collection process going on. So the number of papers that have been entered at the moment is about 1,500. So this is much larger than what we heard about in the previous talk, and also what I have. Ours is about a tenth of what we see here. The experiments are more because there are several experiments, so individual result images per paper. And each experiment, of course, records many locations, so there are even more of those. The paradigm classes that you also list on the website also increase, and this is the sort of the type of study that is going on. There are models and ways of interrogating the data and so on. The process, I really like this paper from Bioinformatics in 2005, where you describe all the trouble that you have gone through in collecting this data. So it's very interesting. The title is Social Evolution of the Human Brain Mapping Database. And it really tells how difficult it is and how many different processes you have been through in order to populate a brain map. And it's impressive the amount of data that you have succeeded in getting in. So now moving to our own database that we call Brede. That is a database, and we emphasize also that it's a search engine. It's very much inspired by BrainMap. Initially, it was copied from BrainMap in the sense that we focused on telerik coordinates. And we have developed some tools on top of that starting point now. That allows us to do things that you cannot do in BrainMap also. We think of it as a kind of sandbox for knowledge discovery in neuroimaging, meaning that we do not believe that it has any sort of complete coverage in any field. So it is really something where we do experiments. We develop methods for these future high coverage databases that we hope will be there. And we can practice in the sandbox with the thing in mind that it's sort of a biased sample. We distribute all our tools. They are programmed and designed and so on, mainly by Finn Aarup-Nielsen. So we distribute this as a MATLAB toolbox that you can download from the website. So all the tools that I'm talking about are available as MATLAB source code. The structure in Brede is that we have some identifiers, some tables. So we have a table for papers that is called BOPIP. We have a description of the experiment. And then we have a lot of external description, a little bit like the paradigm classes of BrainMap. But they have many different aspects. I'll show you when we look at the search engine, what external components, what they and how rich a set that we are operating with. And then we have a description of authors, and also because we are recently trying to populate this database also with region of interest-based data from molecular brain imaging, we have a structure for regions of interest in Brede. So we've tried to make it linked it with several other types of neuroscience databases. So all the papers have links to PubMed. Some of the analyses are based on data sets that are in fMRI-DC, and especially the external components have links to many different databases. For example, recently we are starting to use Wikipedia as a common sense type information structure, and we're increasingly linking to articles in Wikipedia and also to genetic databases when that is relevant. Also for the region of interest, we have links to the relevant databases, including COCOMAC, for example. And all these tools for handling the links, they are also available in the MATLAB programs if you're interested. This is how the search engine looks, and let me see if I can get it to play. So the because of the projector, of course, the screen is very sort of condensed now, so it's a little hard to see what is here. Let me move back so that it's a little random what's happening also. So there's this is the entry, and since it's a kind of sandbox, I mean, we're sort of very open about what is in there. So we have the different tables and ways of accessing the tables. We have some examples also. Let's do an example. For example, the London taxi driver's morphometry. So this is an example of structural changes in London taxi drivers. Their navigation systems are better. And on the fly, these visualizations, they're very hard to see here because of the scale. They usually fill only a fraction of the screen. But this is the kind of three-dimensional display of the regions that are reported. If you want to use the search engine, just kind of writing something. So now I'm going to write something, taxi. So we're using Google to help the search. So of course we didn't find anything when I had the why, but it proposes the right thing. And we have this search in the database that is focused on the site that we have, and then of course narrowed to the tables that we're looking at. So again, we can go to this study, and then all the metadata is available, and the coordinates are available, and one can inspect those, and these images here can be produced as real images that you can download also and save. Go back to the front page. If you want to have a look at, for example, the external components, there's a list, an alphabetic list. So these are all the different concepts that have arisen in the entry process. So it's a huge list of concepts that are all linked to different places for explanations and so on. You can query the database also by location. So this means that if you have found some coordinates, and I'll show you a mechanism for entering coordinates from SPN later on, you can enter these and search based on coordinates, and there are some examples down here also. Then we will produce, if it works, it will produce a list of coordinates in the database that are close to this point that we queried, and one can find the papers that are relevant for that area. So I think I'm going to continue now, and if you want to play around with it, we can do that later on. The address is available also in the last thing that we're going to upload for the IPAM website. So these are the numbers for Bredda at the moment. So we have 180 papers, 600 experiments, and 4,000 coordinates. And it has these features. Yeah, I didn't show the ontology. I'll skip that. But this is a description of the external components in generality. So the more general concepts have children that are specializations, for example, in paradigms and so on. Face recognition with fearful expressions is a child of face recognition and so on. That kind of ontology structure is built in. I'm going to speak about now some of the machine learning tools that we use to create the search and to clean the database and so on. And the basic mechanism that we're using is similar to what we heard about in from Tomarco, the idea of reconstructing the SPM from the coordinates. This idea was proposed in two papers that came out in 2002. Turmutov's paper came in neuroimage, and our paper came in human brain mapping, describing this idea of using passing windows for producing a map based on a set of points. We want to reconstruct the density of the points, and the idea is in the passing window estimator shown here in the little window. So we have some coordinates. This is just a one-dimensional example. It's happening in 3D telluric space in Bredda. And if we use this idea here of placing a kernel that has a weight 1 over n, and n is the number of coordinates in the given map, so these are normalized Gaussians with width sigma, then of course the width of sigma will determine the structure of the map. And we use simple machine learning method for estimating sigma for the given coordinate set that will produce a nice smooth map based on the coordinates that is not too biased by large sigma or not too narrow by a... so this is the optimal one, and this is one that is too narrow, and this is the one that is too wide in the sense of generalizability. So this is what I talked about in the talk yesterday, that the generalizability means that we should be able to predict a coordinate from the other ones. So this is a kind of leaf one out estimator of the generalization error that we use to produce the optimal width here in the reconstruction. So once we have reconstructed the volume, we have a density across the whole of Tellurian space, and we need to define a pixelation if we want to use it for comparative. So for example, comparing two point sets, we reconstruct two maps on the same voxelation, and now we can compare the two just by simple metrics in vector spaces. And this is the way that we create our similarity measures between coordinate sets or between papers and so on. The first way we used it was to clean our database. And actually, this was in the 2002 paper, and there we're using the BrainMap data. So the first database that we used this cleaning principle for was the BrainMap. So we produce a density for the coordinates. Now, if we just take all the brain map coordinates, of course we'll get a density that sort of more or less covers the brain. So that's not very interesting. What we have to do is to label or make conditional densities. So we take the metadata, in this case, in the data set that we downloaded in early 2000, we had about 1,200 labeled terms. And a couple of hundred of those had so many coordinates with them that we could make a stable density. So we made these hundreds of densities that were conditioned on, for example, in this case, the word cerebellum. So this will produce in this display here, so this is what we call a corner cube, that's developed initially by Kelly Wren, where you see the sort of an outline of the brain, and you have projections on the wall here, it's kind of wallpaper and carpet, and then we have this three-dimensional structure here that is the ISO density surface in the 3D space. So now the problem with the cleaning procedure is that we want to eliminate outliers or strange points, strange in the sense that they shouldn't belong to the cerebellum sample. But they, of course, also influence the density estimator itself. So we have to do this in a two-step procedure where we first estimate the density and then shrink by a factor that should sort of roughly be the uncertainty in reporting coordinates. So in this case, 5% of the coordinates should be just random if we're using thresholded T's, for example, and so on. So in this case, we shrink the map from this the wireframe to the solid surface here. And now the points, these yellow star-like objects that are out here, are the ones that have very low densities. They're outside the main density for the cerebellum. And these are candidates for these, what we should call novelty. We don't know yet whether they are outliers or noise. And so we did this for all these many densities and listed the most novel in the sense of least likely data points. And for these points, we, of course, some of them we could see immediately that they were one. They had one point, for example, was way outside the brain volume. So that was a mistake in the entry. Where the units were mistaken. But there are also more subtle mistakes where it was only when you conditioned on the labels that you could see that these points were wrong. For example, there were mirroring errors where the assign was wrong in the coordinate axis, for example. Also, many of these where we couldn't sort of spot immediately the error, we contacted the authors. And of course, some came back and to us and said that this, we really believe that these are true coordinates, and therefore these are novel, these are unexpected findings in the light of the rest of the coordinates, and we need to include those in the database, of course, if there's no reason to throw them away. For the cerebellum, we can compare the volume we get also with published volumes, and here is one that is comes from the Telluric Atlas, and there's one from the ICBM consortium also, just for comparison. And one is somewhat smaller than the one we have, and another one is a bit larger. So all in all, the volume that we got conferred nicely with what we think is the cerebellum. So I'm going to talk about now an example of doing meta-analysis using some of the machine learning tools that we have available to us in Bredene also. So in this case, we wanted to say something about the posterior cingulate cortex. And the reason was a study made by Daniela Batzler, where she was finding some unexpected activations in this region. And if you look into the literature, there are a couple of reviews, meta-analysis reviews, manual reviews, and they're not quite clear about the function. I mean, there are several functions reported, and whether it's a homogeneous region and so on, or something that we're interested in. So therefore, we started a meta-analytic study of brain imaging papers that reported activation in that particular region. So in PubMed, we made a query of this structure here, so it involved either MRI or PET, and different synonyms for the region we're interested in, and that retrieved about 300 abstracts. So at this point, we don't have the coordinates. We only have the abstracts. Now we're going to do some text analysis on the abstracts. And then for certain papers that we will find that this analysis are interesting, we're going to enter them into the database and thus get the coordinates entered into the database. So the kind of text mining we're doing on the abstract is what we call bag of words. So that's the sort of standard machine learning way of approaching text, where you create a term list of terms of interest. First you start with all the words that you have, and then you have different words that you want to eliminate, very common words, very common scientific words. And there are some standard, what's called stop word lists, available also in the PubMed system. And this reduced the number of terms of interest for us to about 500. And we then get a term document frequency matrix by for all the individual abstracts, simply counting how often do the different words in the term list occur in the abstract. So this will give us a matrix that is number of terms by number of abstracts to work with as a representing as a way of representing the text information in all the abstracts. And we're going to use a factor model like I talked about yesterday, where we have the matrix here, and we're going to write it as a few columns and a few rows, so that the total matrix is approximated by the product of the two. Now, if you're successful in doing this, then the interpretation of a column in W is a kind of topic vocabulary. So one column will represent a certain topic, and the way the terms are used would be the way the vocabulary is used in that particular topic. And the corresponding row in H will be the expression of that topic in a given abstract. So a column here is an abstract, and that abstract has a different columns here expressed to a certain extent that is measured by the value H. Now, the way that we get the W and H is by non-negative matrix factorization that was made popular by Danny and Sebastian Song in the paper that I mentioned also yesterday. I'm going to add a little bit to the discussion here, namely that there's a probabilistic interpretation of the NMF in this particular context where we have counts data. So if we take the matrix and normalize it simply by the sum of all the entries, then the resulting matrix that has the same form as the original V, of course, we just divided all the numbers by the total, is going to be an approximation of the joint probability of a term occurring in a document. So that joint probability can be factorized using the factorization we get from the NMF algorithm in two probabilities, namely the probabilities over the terms in context number k or topic number k, right? And then these are the expressions. This is now a probability. We normalize this so they sum to 1 in j and I respectively. And then the two numbers that we need to normalize to get these to be probabilities is the probability of the actual component to be present in a given drawer of a document. So that's the probability of the topic in the database. So this interpretation of NMF was first proposed by Gauthier and Good in a paper a couple of years ago. And it's a very useful way of thinking about this because the probabilities are nice to make inference by, but also the fact that we can interpret the outcome of the NMF algorithm is convenient, because the NMF algorithm is a much faster way of getting the probabilities than the conventional way of doing that, what is called probabilistic latent semantic indexing, where you run an EM algorithm that is somewhat slower in convergence and also has a less efficient implementation in terms of RAM for sparse matrices. Now, we do this for different component sizes. So with this interpretation of the probabilistic interpretation, we can use the standard model selection tools if we want to find a single best number of components. But here we were interested in looking at the structure of the components and the topics that appear as you increase the number of topics in the representation, so the number of columns of W. And so one row here is a certain K, capital K, number of components. And these words that are highlighted, I don't think you can see them, but when we upload the PDF, you can have a look at it, or in the paper. These are the keywords. So this is in the vocabulary, the words that are most characteristic, have the highest probability for the, so this is the highest probability in the corresponding W column. So there's a memory component here that seems to be enforced. So these links between the different levels here are how similar the vocabularies are. So a thick line here means that it's a sort of stable component. So here the memory component breaks in two, but they're very interlinked also. So these are not independent components. These are simply two slightly different ways of using vocabulary in two different subsets of the abstracts. There are other components that have heavy mass. So there's a pain component that we found interesting. There's a post-traumatic stress syndrome component, and there's an Alzheimer component also that has significant mass. And we tested now with the coordinates that we extracted from papers that belong to these different, so the abstracts that were highly loaded on the components, extracted coordinates and tried to look for the homogeneity of the distribution within the posterior singlet. So set of components that came out that has a significant difference between the coordinate sets between the pain and memory. So this is three views, and you can see that there's a clear segregation between the coordinate sets. The three angular shaped objects here are pain coordinates, and the green ones are the memory components. So there seems to be an inhomogeneity in the posterior singlet based on this analysis. And when we go back and look at the reviews that we have, I mean, this is not in conflict, because some of the neighboring regions are mentioned also, and they load heavily onto these components in a way that is consistent with the pattern that we find. When we run the, so I'm now going to the similarity metric that we use for finding similar papers. So this is if we upload coordinates, or we take the coordinates from a paper and we want to find other papers that are similar in coordinates. We use the reconstructed volumes, as I mentioned earlier, a simple correlation between the two volumes as a distance measure between point sets. Sometimes we include the sign also, so this is something that we also have to observe, of course, in these coordinate sets. That sometimes there's a sign of the reported activation, so we have negative activations also, and you can include those in these measures here to make it sensitive to the sign if you're interested in that. So now, thinking about this as a search engine, and hopefully in the long run, what we would call a proactive search engine, you can sort of specify what you would like to see from a useful search engine, and what I've said here is an extremely useful search engine. So a useful search engine, I'd say, should have a very good coverage of the neuroimaging data. This is what we have not been able to achieve so far. We have very limited coverage in our database. BrainMap has much higher coverage, but still it's limited corresponding to the numbers we saw earlier. It's maybe still a few percent that we have in the databases. But not only should it have neuroimaging, it should also have published results from the cognitive and behavioral psychology, so that we can make inferences between, say, based on the abstracts using the text mining ideas. And then, of course, it should have an efficient query interface. And I'm not sure that we have the right thing there. I'm going to show you in a moment what may be sort of the next generation of interfaces that will make this more useful. an extremely useful neural imaging search engine. I think you'll agree if we had, say, all the fields that are relevant for neural imaging included, so that you can make search also in methods, for example, and other types of other parts of doing neural imaging experiments. And of course, raw data is what we all dream of, having the complete coverage of raw data, then we'll be in really good shape. Workflows would be interesting to have, so we could describe, hopefully in a standardized way, how the maps were produced. So people are increasingly using this notion of workflows and storing workflows in standardized formats. And this will allow us eventually to do that, to upload the workflow also. And then we need the proactive user interface that we have sort of an idea of. So this is what I'm going to call a Science 2.0 interface. And the first version of it is going to be announced soon. We have it running in beta at back home. We have some test pilots that are happy about it, so it's going to be released quite soon. We call this the Bread plugin for SPM. So the idea is implementation is a toolbox for SPM that you drop in the toolbox directory, and then you can get the activated inside the SPM. And it intercepts the SPM pipeline, and at the moment it extracts coordinates. So this means that you can take the coordinates from the study that you're doing at the moment and make a search into the toolbox, and just as I showed before, either for a specific coordinate point or for a whole set of coordinates, finding the papers that are most similar. When you do that, you get a result page here, as I'm showing, and also the possibility of downloading the references in different standard formats. And of course, since it's a sort of sandbox database, very small database, this is not going to be all the papers that are relevant. I mean, it would be if we had the good coverage that we would hope for. What we're working on is a way for people who use this and who are interested in participating in this to create sort of like a Flickr interface where you can upload in two different levels. So one would be a private, where you can share your coordinates with collaborators. So this is like the private sharing of images in Flickr. And then once the paper is published and has been through the review process, then you can make the coordinates public for everybody to search. And of course, the reward that you would get is that your papers will be referenced because they are going to appear in those BibTeX or EndNotes files. So we hope that would be sort of an incentive to actually use the interface and also upload the coordinates. Whether it's a strong enough reward, I mean, it's unclear. We'll see. So my conclusions now. So I think that we will all agree, although I have a little question mark here, that knowledge discovery is increasingly important for scientists in general and certainly for our neural images. It's hampered a lot at the moment by the slow growth of the database. I mean, we have very scattered samples, and if we could create sort of an attractive interface, then it may assist. So my idea was here just to make a quick vote. If this was available, how many of you would upload coordinates to it? Wow. It's going to happen. all right. So the other conclusion, of course, is that, I mean, it is a very noisy, even if we had all the coordinates, I mean, it would still be a very noisy database, and therefore we need robust methods from machine learning that are very, very careful about the generalizability of the models in order to not overfit the data and so on. And hopefully, in the long run, we'll also be able to convince researchers to share their raw data, and maybe in between the a bit more informative data structures, namely the result maps that different contrast will produce. Let me just again thank our sponsors that are generously supporting this research. It's very expensive to run, and we are grateful for the support. Thank you.
Okay, are there any questions for Lars?
Yes. I noticed in the beginning that you wrote something like a keyword as EEG and other methods. And I'm wondering, because that's a big problem in fMRI research, that people only cite fMRI papers.
Yeah.
And is it possible to do a search for, let's say, lesion database, like a human lesion?
So in the database, we have a few non-fMRI PET studies. So we have some that are morphometry, for example. And I think we have a few EEG studies also. And of course, as people start to use SPMs, EEG, 3D brain mapping facilities, for example, if that took off, then it would be very easy to use the framework for uploading these coordinates. But I think that's a very good ambition that we should include EEG data also, find ways of including also more conventional EEG studies where we only have the scalp map, for example. Still interesting to have.
Yeah. Other questions? Well, I think we all see the importance of meta-analysis, and tools like this would be a great leap forward in being able to do meta-analysis on many different types of studies. So let's thank our speaker one more time.